Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
What's up, everybody? Welcome to Completely Arbitrary, the podcast about trees and other related topics. I'm just one of your two hosts. My name is Alex Croson, and alongside the incredible, the edible...
I didn't know I'm edible. What do I taste like? I'm Casey Clapp. I assume I taste like Casey Clapp.
I actually did this bit, this exact same bit last episode, and you said you tasted like a mother's circus animal cookie.
Really? Is that what I said?
Yes.
I mean, I remember that, but I didn't know that you said I was edible.
I edited that episode today.
Oh, and I said that.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
The pink ones, you said.
Yeah, it's because they're, you know, obviously.
Yeah.
Wow, man. Short-term memory. Look at me.
Not great, but you can also say eggs, because that's sort of where that comes from, the incredible edible egg.
Oh, that's true. I don't think I taste like eggs, though.
No.
However, I do, as I was sitting here, I'm drinking a Super Berry Brew Doctor Kombucha. Mm-hmm. By the way, Brew Doctor, still waiting for that check.
Oh, man. We tried to get them as a sponsor, and they said no.
I don't even think they said no. I think they were just like, we're not going to reply to that.
No, they did. They did reply
they
to us.
They did?
Yeah, they said that they don't do podcast sponsorships at the moment.
But wow.
They, if that ever changes, they'll reach out.
Of course they will. Anyway.
No harm, no foul. We love Brew Doctor.
It's reasonable. I'm in the mood for macaroni and cheese right now.
Wow. That sounds good.
Yeah, the box kind. Like, I don't want anything fancy. Mm-hmm. I just want one from probably Annie's.
Okay.
Hey, Annie's. They're way too big. Now, Annie's isn't going to do that. No, we can't. I can't even try to force that.
Yeah, let's go with a smaller company like Kraft.
Yeah, just, you know, a mom and pop shop.
Casey, we have a really cool tree to discuss today, but before that happens...
Ooh, do we?
We have something to clear up. I have something to clear up.
Oh, yes. All right. Hit us up. What do you got? What's going on?
In our last episode, we had talked about catkins.
Sure, I remember this.
On the aspen.
That's
the quaking
right.
aspen.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, huh, they kind of look like caterpillars.
Ah,
and
yeah.
Then, of course, my brain clicked, and I thought, huh, I wonder if catkin and caterpillar come from the same root etymologically, right?
I see, yeah.
So I looked it up. Here's what I found. This is from, like, an etymology dictionary.
Okay. And
so this first one is regarding caterpillar.
Do they hang down? Is that it? It's just strictly looks? Is that what this is going for? I'm trying to preempt it without reading what you're about to say.
Well, let me do my thing, and then we'll talk about it.
All right.
Larva of a butterfly or moth, mid-15th century, caterpill.
Ah,
probably,
that's a fun spelling.
Yeah, right? It's Y-R-P-E-L. I give for that.
I love that.
Probably altered by association with Middle English pillar, which means plunderer or pillage, you know?
Oh, like, would it altered? Like, so caterpillar, is it like it plunders something? It's a...
Yeah. Maybe.
Okay, sorry,
and then
keep going.
From Old North French, caterpillou.
Pilous. If there's an E at the end, you pronounce the vowel before the thing before it.
Pilous. And then, which literally means shaggy cat. So now we're on to something.
I like where we're going. Okay.
We're on to something here, because that means shaggy cat.
Shaggy cat. Caterpillos.
Right.
Caterpillos.
Means shaggy cat.
Caterpillos.
There you go. Your first one was in a Russian accent.
Yeah, it was. You know what? Everything.
Russian French.
Everything I do the first time is in a Russian accent.
Anybody can be from anywhere.
Yeah. Go back and listen to episode one of Completely Arbitrary. Whole thing's in Russian.
There you go. Compare also French chenille.
Ah, probably in reference to the woolly bear. You skipped over that. Shaggy cat.
Oh, right.
It's a woolly bear. Are you familiar with the woolly bear?
No.
Oh, my God. It's those little black and orange caterpillars that, I think they're actually a moth of some kind, that are really, really fuzzy. Like, they look like you could just pet them. Like, they're little, like, they're adorable.
Right.
And they actually live in, like, Arctic and live for, like, several years, these individual caterpillars, and they will sit and get completely frozen through, like, ice solid through. Wait till the season turns, then they'll pop back to life, continue eating, and they'll just do that until during they get a good enough season that they can pupate and become a an adult.
You're kidding.
Not kidding
they
at all.
They get frozen solid and they thaw back alive.
That's right. Little Jeez. Woolly bears.
Wow.
Shaggy cats.
Yeah, so there's something there. But then also, Catkin literally just comes straight from kitten.
Really? That's
yes.
it?
So, I don't know if this answers our questions or just presents new ones.
Well, it does. Well, I'm so curious. Where? So, Catkin comes from kitten.
Yeah.
So, what does that mean? Catkin, you mean it's like the kin of a cat?
Catkin.
I don't understand.
Comes from kitten.
Where does it come from? How does that reference to a tree?
Well, the catkins look like cattails.
Really? Are you kidding me?
That's my assumption.
That it makes sense.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Cattail also a plant.
It is true.
We should have a segment where we talk about plants that are named after animals.
Sounds good to me. I'll do it.
And then animals that are named after plants.
There's a dogwood. Yeah. What did we got? The tree tree vole.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Lives in a tree and it's a vole. Pretty interesting stuff there, Alex.
Super
if I
interesting.
I say so myself.
You can see from the shape of my raised eyebrows, I'm extremely interested.
They look like two peaks.
Anyway, so yeah, that's what we have. That's what we have here.
I'm so curious about this though, because if Catkin just comes straight from kitten,
yeah.
Why would they call that the tree thing? Because they don't all look like little cattails, and cattails don't even look anything like catkins, because catkins are like the things that hang down and are like these pendulous fruiting bodies.
Those don't look like cattails?
I don't think so. Like, they look kind of disjunct. Like, look up a birch catkin. It doesn't look anything like it. You might also look up the... I guess it depends on what the first catkin was that they are referring to.
I'm looking at a birch catkin. 100% looks like a cattail.
Oh, get out of town, Alex. You don't even know what a cattail looks like.
I've never even seen a cat.
All right. Catkin etymology.
Is this compelling radio?
It better be. Late 16th century from obsolete Dutch katakin, kitten. I don't understand it.
Yeah, man.
I don't get it. I don't like this. I'm upset.
Well, anyway. You know, language is often confusing and random.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I'm just, it's so curious because I guess it is, it's random. But I want to know why that became the scientific, sexual, reproductive thing on plants and how it comes from kitten. It just seems so innocuous.
Yeah. Well, maybe somebody will write in to us, an etymological person.
Please do. In fact, I think what I really want to do now is just call, like, if I see a little kid, and I'm going to be like, oh, that's just a cute little spike of unisexual apotaceous flowers having scaly, usually deciduous bracts. Oh, my God.
I think if you said that to my cat, I would be like, Casey, I can't have you around my cat anymore.
You need to go. Oh, come on. A unisexual apetalous flower.
Very cute name for a cat.
Yeah, that's going to be the full name of my cat. I'm just going to call it Catkin. And then we're going to be like, what does Catkin stand for? I'm like, well, it's a long story.
What does it stand
for? But it hangs down usually. It's an acronym.
Casey, today we have a pretty cool tree that I, again, don't know much about.
This is exciting.
It's kind of a trend here.
Hey, first time for everything.
I do know its genus.
Tell us.
Well, this is an Acer tree.
Yes. And where does Acer come from, Alex? Did you look into this?
Where does the word Acer come from?
Yeah.
No, I did not look into this.
Oh, I learned that it comes from sharp.
Okay.
Yeah. So Acer, they assume it's either lance, or like, you know, the leaves are sharply pointed.
Uh-huh.
That's what some assumptions are. But apparently there's also some etymology that brings it back to like hard or something like that. I think it's like Celtic Ock or Us. It's AC. I don't know the pronunciation.
Interesting. There's also a brand of like computer, monitors called Acer.
Yeah, I don't know what that. I don't know. I think that comes from like building trees, like the computer trees. There's something about that.
Well, I was going to say Sharp because it's a sharp image.
Oh, nice, I
clear,
see.
Sharp image.
Looks like someone dove pretty far at the Acer company to find out, you know, what they're going to do here.
Yeah.
Why didn't we spend that much time on our, come up with a really good pun or, some really deep, 16 different meanings layered deep for our show? I feel like we just kind of called it in.
Yeah, we phoned it in a bit. We had to be home by 5 o'clock.
That's
we
were like, true. I didn't want to ride my bike home in the dark.
There is no better metaphor for this show than just its title being just a shit pun.
Yeah, exactly. A really poor pun.
Yeah.
Everyone's like, well, we know what we're expecting here.
And here's a little behind the scenes spoiler for everybody. It was our best option.
That was, yeah. Imagine being on the top of that pile. Good for us. Good for everyone.
A real king fly on top of a big pile of shit.
Thanks for sticking with us, you guys.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. We love and appreciate you. Anyway, Casey.
Anyway.
We're talking today about the Japanese maple mm-hmm. Acer palmatum.
Palmatum. Yes. I would pronounce it differently.
Palmatum.
Yes, it just flows a little easier. It means like the palm of your hand.
Well, how about that?
Yeah. Of course, it's referring to the leaves,
the
of
leaves.
Which everyone is very familiar, or at least should be, kind of superficially, with the classic maple leaf, with those points that come out all from that central area, palmately lobed, not compound.
See, at least in this case. I think it's a bit redundant to call the Japanese maple Acer palmatum.
Why is that?
Because aren't most maple leaves palmate?
Ah, they in fact are not, my friend. There you go.
Aren't enough for it to be not so rare that this single species be named after palmate leaves.
I guess that's true.
Well, Casey, as we do every week, let's imagine that you and I are walking through, and I'd like to say that we are walking through the Japanese gardens here in Portland, Oregon.
Oh.
Where I know there are many of these trees.
True.
And we come across some Japanese maples. And we are stunned because they're beautiful.
Stunned.
Casey, let's talk about what they look like. Let's talk about leaf, bark, stem, morphology.
I love when you ask me these questions.
Margin.
Alex. Makes me so happy. The Japanese maple is a maple tree. As we've discussed before, maples in the genus Acer, they have oppositely arranged leaves that come out. So if their leaves and their buds are opposite, then their twigs and all their branches will have at least begun opposite, whether or not one died or moved on or something like that. But what is so classic about these is that they have these little tiny leaves. Like, they're not big leaves. They're maybe the size of some of them are like, I don't know, maybe 2 inches around, maybe three. They're really not big, but what they're famous for is having these 5 to 7 lobes that come out, and they kind of are a little fatter at the base, these lobes, and then they skinny down to what's called an acuminate tip, which means their tip is just pointed.
Yeah.
And it has it just kind of comes down and is very, very, not sharp. It looks sharp, but it's just not sharp. It's the best way I can describe it. They look tough and scary, and they're just not tough and scary. They have serrated margins on each one of these 5 to 7 lobes. Mm. And usually the sinuses, which are the incise, the space in between the lobes, those are generally really deep. So they have really long, fingery looking lobes.
The sinuses.
Yeah, that's space in between.
Okay, this is a new one for me.
Is? Yeah. I love it. I always make a joke when I'm talking about tree ID stuff where science has to name the things in between the things that they named.
Right. So the Japanese maple leaves have deep sinuses.
For the most part, yeah. And on top of that, because these trees have been in cultivation for so long, there are now other varieties that are even deeper lobed. Like, they're called lacely leaf maples.
Whoa.
And they're like, it goes all the way down, like almost to the stem, so it looks almost like you have these individual leaflets along these lobes. It's not quite the case, but they look lacy. Like, it's the perfect name for something because it fits the definition perfectly.
They start to look a little compound.
Yeah, they start to do that, and then the serrated margins along each one of those, they get really deep as well. So you get these really beautifully, classically laced leaf maples. That's the one that you're going to see at the Japanese garden.
I've seen these.
Yeah.
For sure. And I love those leaves.
They're so gorgeous, aren't they?
They almost remind me of like, if like a cypress needles were like in leaf form.
I see. Yeah. If they just had like a translation into leaf.
All right. So the leaves sound fantastic. They look fantastic. Beautiful leaves.
Super gorgeous. They turn usually a really dark, like orange, red in the color or in the fall time.
Yeah.
But the thing about these trees is that they are also, they're kind of like a snake barky kind of tree. They don't get very big, maybe 30 or 40 feet tall. I mean, 40 feet would be gargantuan for these trees.
Wow.
They stay really small. And they usually grow kind of multi-stemmed and outward. So you're never going to see, rarely at least, one single stem that comes up and then bushy top. It's going to be like one stem splits into two, splits into five, and then kind of just comes out in these low-lying shrubby looking things.
Yeah, it's a bit like it reminds me, I think since you said snakes, it looks like snakes, like almost like a Medusa head, like
most definitely
coming out of one point, just like all these like slithering branches that kind of grow out.
And they never touch each other, just kind of always going away.
Yeah.
It's a perfect look. And the bark adds to it because the bark on the tree usually has that same like striations going up the side. So it's individual spots where the bark is kind of splitting as, you know, the inside is expanding out.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it doesn't get like big deep furrows on it. It just slowly kind of stays flat but has these ridges that are very shallow, but you can see very clearly the differences in the color.
Interesting.
And there's even some species of maple called snake bark maples that do that specifically and look so gorgeous. One, I think it's Acer pennsylvanicum from the eastern United States. Mm. It does this and it just is so, they're just so cool. The bark is so top-notch.
Sounds great.
So, other thing to note is they had these little samaras, those little maple keys are what they're called, the little helicopters.
Oh, yeah.
They got them.
Sweet.
Yep, they still do, because, of course, every maple does. This is a classic maple definition or defining trait.
Yeah, if you're trying to ID a tree and it has these.
Exactly. And if you you find the Japanese maple, you find the big leaf maple, you find the Norway maple, you find the Acer pennsylvanicum, then you also find, say, the Acer negundo, that's the box elder.
Okay.
Those are five or six different species, and each one of those will have leaves that look completely different. Some will be huge, some will be small, some will be pinnate, some will have no lobes at all, some will not even look, they'll look like normal, simple leaves with maybe even some serrations around the edge. But each one of those will have the same kind of fruit. It'll have variations as well, but you'll still see two seeds connected with a stem in the middle and then two wings coming off. And those are called winged samaras.
I love those.
They're so great. But the fun thing about these trees, though, is that there are, I think, 300 or 400 different cultivars, Alex.
Wow.
So many.
As a participant in Completely Arbitrary, I know that Japanese horticulture is just a huge universe of cool stuff.
It's insane.
Gardening, big time.
Yep.
And then what was the Japanese?
Bonsai. Bonsai trees.
Well, yes, that is also a thing. But what was the other Japanese tree we did on our world tour?
Oh, that was the cherry tree, cherry.
Yes. Huge in the cultivarization world.
It totally is. And it's the same kind of thing where they were just people who had these trees, found them, and then just crossbred them and slowly but surely just took their time to find the most beautiful, specifically like poetic trees.
Yeah.
And just bred those out. But the point is, if you find a Japanese maple, you could find one that's growing kind of normally upright, kind of like the one that's out here, which I think is probably about 25 feet tall, maybe outside your house.
Sounds right.
It's that big. However, you'll find some that have the normal green leaves, because if you're walking around Japan, most of these trees just have normal green leaves.
Yeah.
They're kind of a darker shade of green, a little bit lighter underneath. Nothing fancy.
I think that's how they look best.
You
personally.
Do? Yeah. Really? Okay.
I don't love the orange or the purple red leaves.
I was going to say, because there is, for those of you who may not be familiar, there's 100 different varieties that have the really dark red or really dark purple, like almost maroon purple.
Yeah.
I think those are really beautiful. I have to say, I really like those.
I would call that color like maybe like Merlot.
Ooh, yes, definitely.
It's like a wine red.
Yeah, I like that. That's a perfect description.
Yeah.
Well, so all those trees, or they have cultivars that have the really really deeply incised and lace-leafed in every shade of purple and red and green that you can imagine. Mm. Then they have them all with the normal leaves, and then they have ones that grow up. Then they have ones that grow directly up. Then they have ones that grow really slowly outwards and kind of spider out. Those are the ones that everyone kind of is super stunned by. They look like it's a Muppet. I can't remember I can't remember the name of the Muppet.
Oh.
But there's some Muppet, or maybe it's like Cousin It from the Addams Family. Something like this. But there's just like this big pillowy blob of foliage. And if you let that just grow and you slowly prune it and you like take your time, that thing will just keep growing and cooking for, you know, 100 years or more.
Yeah.
And then you have this big gigantic globe of just this really curvy, like sinuous bark and or sinuous tree that's growing out that is not straight. Like there's not a single straight branch on it. Mm-hmm. Everything is super curly and wavy and all kind of moving away from each other. It's super beautiful, especially if you get underneath one of those and like look up. It's like, what? It's crazy. Well, let's see. The last thing to note about these trees is that they generally are always going to be like small trees that really like to be not in the center of attention.
Uh-huh.
This is something, though, that people really want them to be.
They have the looks of a Hollywood movie star.
They do, and especially if you have a like artist or someone who really understands how to prune them and form them.
Yeah.
Man, like now let's go back to the Portland Japanese Garden, which if you have not gone, people, please go do that. It is noted as one of the best outside of Japan by a like famous Japanese artist or gardener many years ago.
Wow.
Solid place. However, the thing about it is there's one like famous, you could just Google it, you like a Japanese maple or Portland Japanese Garden maple, and it's there. It's like on the front of every catalog in the city or like
so many postcards from Portland have
exactly.
this on them.
And it's usually in fall and it's like this gorgeous orange red, but that tree has been meticulously taken care of and they prune out a lot of the stuff to keep it really open because they're like, no, the bark and the texture and the way it's growing is a part of the aesthetics of the tree. So they actually prune it and thin it so you can see through the canopy and actually see all these twists and turns of the stems and the twigs and the branches and everything. Not very good for the tree, but yeah, whatever. It's beautiful.
Oh, okay.
it's like wearing something that's so uncomfortable, but you look so good in it. It's
right.
Like, it's not always the best.
Speaking of Hollywood actors.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. This is the movie star.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a shade tolerant, small understory tree that has been put out into the limelight, Alex.
And Casey, we're going to talk more about stories.
Oh.
After the break. We'll be right back with more Completely Arbitrary. Hi, everybody. Or should I say, hola a todos. I want you to hear something. It's this. Yes, that is the sound of learning a new language with Babbel. You have, of course, heard of Babbel. You've maybe even used Babbel. But if you haven't, Babbel is an app that helps you learn languages. Babbel is a science-backed learning language app that actually works. Let me put it this way. I knew somebody who used a different language app for 365 days and still could not even have basic conversations in the language they were learning on that app. Babbel is not this. They have quick 10-minute lessons and they're handcrafted by 200 language experts so you can start learning a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Because it's designed by real people for real conversations. In fact, a recent study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. And of course, the best way to learn a new language is immersion. You go and live in the place where the people speak the language you're learning. You speak to the people, they speak back. But the second best way is Babbel. And it's practical. It will very quickly teach you how to order food, ask for directions, speak to shopkeepers without having to consult language apps while you're on vacation. And here is a special limited time deal for our listeners right now. Get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription. but only for Fungal Associates at babbel.com/trees. That's right. If you're listening to this, if you're a fan of this show, babbel.com/trees, get 60% off your subscription. That's babbel.com/trees. Rules and restrictions may apply. Adios. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Hi, everybody. It's Alex here. And you know what? Come springtime, those trees are a-bloomin'. Those people are a-walkin' around. That sun is a-shinin'. And it makes me so grateful for my social life. People are wanting to do things again. And it can be extremely rewarding to start to see friends more often and, you know, go on cute friend dates or romantical dates, sit on a patio and drink a coffee. Ooh la la. But it's really easy to overdo it. And for me, it's very important to keep an eye on my social battery. Every time I go on a social outing, I come home and I'm like, wow, I am really tired in a very specific way. Well, that's my battery. That's my social battery being drained. And I didn't really have this language until I started going to therapy. I didn't know why being around people made me so exhausted, even though I love those people and enjoy being around them. But therapy helped me with my self-awareness and helped me unlock some language that I didn't otherwise have. And if you are struggling with feelings and thoughts that you don't understand, therapy can be a great way to unlock the power of understanding. And a great way to start is BetterHelp. It's completely online and it's designed to be super convenient and flexible, which is very important. How many times have you had a therapy session on the calendar and that time rolls around and you think, I gotta drive all the way across town. I am not gonna go. It has, of course, happened to me. I'm sure it's happened to everybody who's been in therapy. No worries with BetterHelp. It's all online. And all you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire. You get matched with a licensed therapist, of course. And nobody nails it on their first time. It's like going on dates. You gotta find the right therapist for you. It's silly to think that the very first date you ever go on is going to be your future spouse. So you can switch therapists at any time, no additional charge. It's extremely easy. So find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/trees today to get 10% off of your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/trees. Happy spring! Welcome back to
Jesus Christ.
Anyway, Alex, let's just keep going from there.
I pumped my... Hey, welcome back to Completely Arbitrary.
Oh, don't edit anything about what just happened.
All
and if
right.
you do, you have to edit this out now, too.
I give you my promise.
Yes!
Today we're talking Japanese maple Acer... Casey?
Palmatum.
it's like a wrestler.
Yeah, exactly.
Acer Palmatum.
Yeah.
This is the hackiest thing we've ever come up with.
Sorry. Well, now we're gonna have to name the show after it. Damn it.
Acer Palmatum, the Japanese maple. Casey,
that's the one.
Right before break, you were talking about understory, overstory.
Mm-hmm, sure was.
Let's get into the meat of this episode.
Let's really talk about this. Now, this is something that I think everyone knows and everyone sees. Alex, are you okay?
Yeah.
What happened?
You know, like when you like roll on your keys or something?
Okay, yeah.
That just happened to me, but like it felt like a shin splint, but like in my forearm.
You're beating yourself up over there. Are you all right?
I'm a little tender today.
Gosh.
I'm kind of sick, and so my body is like, just every little thing hurts.
I'm so sorry.
So that probably technically, like chemically, didn't hurt that bad.
Oh, I see.
But it just felt terrible.
I really appreciate your use of the term chemically hurt. It's like, you know, like, no, that hurt more in my
psychologically.
Yeah, okay, thank you. I'm going to start trying to make those definitions. Honestly, yikes. I'm fine, but psychologically, I'm crying.
Yes.
That was awful.
All right, sorry to interrupt with my grimace.
What are you talking about? We are here to support you.
Oh,
and make sure you're okay. That's the only reason for this podcast.
Oh my God.
We're talking about stories, Alex.
Yeah.
Now, the story that we're going to tell today.
Oh, let me guess. The Lord of the Rings.
We're going to talk about the Lord of the Rings. We are talking about the kinds of stories that are only written in the forest by the trees.
Right, beautiful.
The upper, the under, the others, all the kinds of stories that exist. So you recall when we were talking about, what tree? You know what? Actually, most of our trees have been overstory trees.
Yeah.
Like, they're the big ones that you see, you know? You walk into a Pacific Northwest forest, you look up and you're like, well, there's a big green canopy above me. Like, there's a whole thing. That's a big Douglas fir. It's a big hemlock. It's a big ponderosa pine. It's something like that, right?
Yeah, I can think of a couple understory trees we've covered. The hawthorn would be considered an understory tree.
Yes, there you go. The hawthorn, and then
the sugar maple, is that an understory?
No, that's a classically big story tree. Yeah, that one takes over, makes entire forests.
Got it.
But you're right. We also did the Japanese cherry. It's kind of an understory tree, but it's another one that is kind of on the side because it's not very shade tolerant.
Right.
And that's the big trick that we're going to be talking about.
Okay.
Is that there are a bunch of trees that once you get enough like canopy space, a whole tree forest grows up and you have this big gigantic forest. As a couple of those bits die or maybe branches break off, you start getting some light that's coming through. That's when all of a sudden you have this whole understory, this whole like underground, I can't say underground because it means maybe a literal thing here, underground in a cultural sense.
Okay.
You know, a whole scene is happening down there.
Yeah.
So you get this whole other, like once the big trees are out of the way, out of earshot, you get this understory canopy that starts growing up, and they're like, hey, there's some light over here, man. You want some of this?
This is the counterculture of the forest.
That's exactly what this is, yes. And so that is the niche that the Japanese maple fits in its native habitat.
Okay.
Now, they have forests over there that are very similar to the Pacific Northwestern forest, although they have a completely different cadre of trees and like historic trees that have come in and like, you know, messed with their forest dynamics, I guess.
Sure.
But they still have like the same kind of pines and upper story things. They have all sorts of maples. Like they're the cast of characters in Japan is really similar to the cast of characters that you'd see across the whole temperate northern area of the world. So through Russia and Europe and China and the United States, all those like temperate deciduous forest trees. But then they also have these like tall peaks mixed with a lot of different conifer kinds of trees. So there's lots of spruces. There's lots of I think they actually might have a species of Douglas fir.
Wow.
Which is weird because it's not really
a species of Douglas fir.
Yeah, like a species of things that would be considered a pseudo suga. It doesn't feel right calling it a Douglas fir.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Anyway, we'll look that up later. Yeah. But they, and just like every other forest, there are certain trees that take up that niche of growing in the understory. And those trees are a little bit more shade tolerant. And that's kind of the weird thing that we're kind of hitting on today, which makes it interesting when we are talking about the amount of energy that a tree can make, you know, per leaf, per the size of the canopy. So when you are dealing with the understory trees, and these could be really big trees, or they could be big trees in the making that are just slowly making their way up under the understory or through the understory.
So it can graduate from understory to overstory.
Exactly. I'm thinking the European beech, classic example. Some oak trees over in the eastern United States do this. Over here, the western hemlock and the noble fir, the western red cedar. These trees also do this. They'll just chill in the understory for as long as it takes. As long as they're just getting every now and then some ambient light that pops in, every now and then they get a little bit, maybe a sunbeam here, sunbeam there for a couple hours a day. They will just sit there and cook. Do easy. Those trees that will graduate and become the overstory trees, They got stars in their eyes. They're looking to go like take the place of some giant when it falls.
Right.
Not the Japanese maple. The Japanese maple has no aspirations to become a canopy dominant tree by any means.
I love that.
It is sufficient to live and just suck off the little beams that come through the canopy.
Just content with its place in life.
It really is. And it does such a good job. What we're really talking about here is this group of plants. If you're over here in the Great Pacific Northwest, you would find the vine maple taking that same little niche. The hawthorn, as you noted, some of the horn beams in the eastern United States as well as in Europe, the hop horn beam, these aren't 100% the same because they're not like really, really shade in or shade tolerant,
mm-hmm.
which means, of course, I should say this, shade tolerant.
Yeah, I was gonna introduce what should we call this? Terminology jam.
Yeah, thank you. Sometimes I forget and I just go off on jargon. Shade intolerant versus shade tolerant is just a means of describing, is a tree able to grow in full sun conditions or part sun conditions or shady conditions?
Right.
And that's really it. And it comes with different traits. So oak trees, especially in the eastern United States, super shade tolerant. They can just sit there in the understory and basically make enough energy to live over the long term with a not intense amount of light touching them.
Right.
Versus a Douglas fir or a shore pine or a loblolly pine, they have to have bright light all the time. If they start getting shaded out, they just go kaput. They can't make it.
Okay.
And you can see these dynamics happening. Again, there's two different kind of levels. There's that the understory, the under canopy trees that are slowly over time becoming the late successional trees. And I know we've talked about this on a couple episodes, or at least on one or two of the Patreons,
mm-hmm.
the idea of forest succession.
Right.
Where you have that first tree, that first grouping of trees, the alders, the Douglas firs, over in the eastern United States, it's mostly pines and different conifers. And then as time happens, older trees die or fall over, or they just get overtaken by these shade-tolerant species that grow in the wings, and they just kind of chill there for a while. They grow up, then they take over, and the entire cast of characters in a forest completely changes over, and now you have a whole different grouping.
Right.
A lot of times over here, that would be the western hemlock or the western red cedar, two classic shade-tolerant species that just cook. Whereas the vine maple is our perfect example, as I said, just like the Japanese maple, they'll just grow out.
Yeah.
And the reason I really think these trees are cool for this reason only is that A, seems so unpretentious, doesn't it, Alex?
The Japanese maple?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They are, it's so ironic because they get such like a high pedestal of like the most gorgeous tree in the world. Like this is great, gorgeous Japanese maple, and they're super beautiful and they have all this history and culture kind of almost literally bred into them because of, you know, how it is.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, if you go find the normal ones, they're trees that they're not asking for a lot. They're just going to slowly grow. And what I think is so cool is that if you were watching me on film right now, you see my arms like moving out kind of like snakes,
mm-hmm.
because they don't tend to grow big and create these like perfect globe areas. So inefficient if the sun is getting blocked by gigantic stems, or over there 20 feet, that's where the light's most intense,
right?
Or over here. So you can see them just put up this really long snaky branch that just comes out and then has like a little plate of leaves right
yes.
here and a little plate of leaves over here. And if you catch it at the right time, you can see that they are growing leaves in the only places where light's coming through the canopy.
Mm.
And then everywhere else on the tree, there's nothing. There's just this long, snaking little branch that comes out. Bloop. There's the light. I'm just going to put my hand out here and just soak it in.
I love that. It's such like unpretentious, simple design.
Yeah, right?
You know? I see light over there. I'm just going to put a branch there.
Classic.
Get
yeah.
some light.
And that is phototropism at its finest.
That's right.
Yeah. So same thing as the drunken spruces and pines up
yeah.
in, I guess it's drunken pine. No, it was spruce. It was the spruce.
Yeah.
The drunken spruces.
Black spruce.
Yes. they will fall over and then grow straight up. Mm-hmm. But that's because they're growing straight up towards the light, famously shade intolerant. So they're not going to grow sideways and kind of sinewy, muscly arms out to try and catch every little spot of light that's coming out.
Yes, phototropism, of course. Trees are phototropic, meaning mm-hmm. that they grow always toward the sun.
Yes, most of the time, at least. I think always is a fine term.
Okay.
I'm trying to say, I'm always so hesitant about saying always. Yeah, it just scares me, Alex.
It always scares you? Casey.
I need to go. That was such a meta fear.
It's a real monster in the closet moment.
Sure is.
Whatever the fuck that means.
Well, so the thing that I love about these trees also is their ecological role in this area. So everyone, of course, like I said earlier, always thinks of the big trees, like the big giants that are out there. That's the forest. It's like, well, no, that's just the upper story.
Right.
As you go down, you have this interesting thing where the birds, like you come to the Great Pacific Northwest, you go out into our forest, you're like, wow, it's a temperate rainforest. You walk out there, it's silent. There's nothing there. And there's nothing there because most of the biomass in terms of the amount of things that live here is all within the trees. So it's the most biomass of any place in the entire world, the Pacific Northwest.
Hmm.
So, all good and well, it's all inside the trees, literally, physically, wood, right?
Yeah.
So, when you have animals that are trying to live and trying to, you know, find food and do things, where are they going to live? They're either going to live way up high in the canopy of those trees, like, you know, the great spotted owl, or the tree vole, the flying squirrels, these kinds of things. There's some salamanders. Other birds that are eating maybe some of the things that live up on these trees. That's about it. As soon as you go down to those gigantic big stems, there's just not a whole lot of stuff there. I mean, it's just bark and dead branches.
Huh.
Now, the dead branches and that bark, it has lots of insects in it, it has lots of things going on, so it's a good place to find forage. But if you are a bird who's trying to actually get some really good nourishment, the vast majority is way down where that shrub layer.
Oof.
But I feel like that's too many. I can't do that.
I go for it. Remember insects that sensitive to scents?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, you're right. Well, it's basically where you get that understory with the medium-sized trees, then the big shrubs, then the little shrubs, then the herbs and the flowers, and then all the detritus and the things growing on the ground.
Yeah.
That's where you get most of the stuff. That's where all of your deer and your big sort of megafauna are. They're not up in the trees. You don't have like, you know, I don't know. I was thinking like the pterodactyls, and I was like, nah, we just don't have really pterodactyls anymore. So I had to try and think of a better big animal that lives up in the canopy.
Mm.
And there's only in Japan, there's like some monkey species that may do that.
Eagles?
That's it. But eagles aren't eating. They're just living up there. They're not eating things in there. Maybe the Cooper's hawk.
Oh,
they might do it.
I see.
But
you're talking about things to be found to eat.
Yes.
Or just, in the overstory.
No. Not that we would eat, but just things that
no,
we...
No, I know. The
okay,
animal.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
Fauna.
Yeah. Fauna. All you get, Alex, is... Or the majority of the species of animals and things that live are in that understory section.
Yeah.
In that like bottom 30 feet. Then there's a big gap. Then there's a bunch of stuff that's further up.
That's interesting to me, that sort of dead zone.
Yeah. Well, and it's only dead. I mean, I should be more specific. It's not necessarily dead everywhere. Like there's different species of trees that grow in different ways. So over here, there is a significant zone of I don't want to say dead, but there's a dip in the number if you're counting and graphing it, where you have different I want to say colonies, but that's not the right term. Just different populations that live down here. Very few things that live up in this area and forage up there. Probably forage. Chickadees, great foragers. They're everywhere. Mm. But then up in the canopy, you have a whole different group, and it's different entirely than what's down here, and they're doing different things.
Right. You can see that zone, too. When you're like in Oregon forest, there's just like this sort of bare strip of like gray-brown.
Yeah.
Where all of the... the shade intolerant pines have just like knocked off their branches
because
they can't survive under the top foliage.
Yeah, and then all that goes away. The Douglas firs do the same thing. And now I don't want to say, and I don't want to lead you to believe that it's a complete dead zone, because there's certainly things that live there and forage there. But as you go further down, I mean, that's where you get all of your mice. That's where you get the majority of the mammal species that fly around, except for bats. And then just walk around. Mm. But then that's where you get all of your insects. Most of the insects are going to be hanging out down there. So this understory canopy is actually a super important place for birds, like even to make their nests, where maybe they're foraging up in the top, maybe they're foraging in the ground. They don't want to put their nest on the ground, and they don't want to have it on those big exposed branches up there. So this shrub layer, this small understory layer, it provides a lot of cover. It provides a lot of food because that's where new insects are hanging out.
Interesting.
Yeah, so you get this whole different group. And the thing that I am so stoked about with this tree and other trees is that it's also what you see, you as a person. So you're walking through a forest.
Yeah, man.
You are only maybe 5 to 10 feet tall. I know there's some big tall people out there. But generally, we're only going to be looking at things in that bottom 20 feet. Everything else, we have to like crane our necks and look up and really see it.
Yes.
So when you're walking around, a lot of people are like, oh yeah, there's a bunch of maples out there. It's like, no, there's no maples. Those are all Douglas firs. You're just seeing the maples because they're the things at your eye level, maybe.
I've told you this before, I think, when we were maybe out walking looking at trees. Something we do often.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it?
I love a tree that you can just see the whole thing.
Yeah, there you go.
I love a tree that you can just like, I can visualize the whole thing because it's like 20, 30 feet tall. Mm-hmm. It's right there. I don't get a lot out of like walking through a forest and looking up and seeing these big skewed perspective. You know, like when you're looking at like a, you know, a 250-foot Douglas fir or whatever, like it doesn't even look like anything.
I gotcha.
It just looks like a giant pole just going into the air.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love a tree that like, oh, from root to the very top leaf, I can see what this thing looks like.
There you go.
That's why I love the Japanese maple so much. And Casey.
Alex.
With that.
I can't believe you went into it so smoothly. You caught me off guard.
Let's give our rating of the Japanese maple. Each episode, we give the tree in question a rating of 0 to 10 golden cones of honor. Casey, as our resident expert, we will begin with you.
All right. Well, as you know, I have love for this tree. Mm-hmm. I also have hate for it because I hate that people like it so much. Is that ironic? Does that put me into a category of hate for myself?
I think it's a little obnoxious.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, that's a little bit like, oh, I only like that band because nobody else listens to them.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But then once they get popular, you're like, fuck that band. Even though the band did nothing wrong.
See, yeah. All right. I get you. I was also thinking it's like someone who's like, ugh, Subarus. Everyone has a Subaru and they have a Subaru.
Right.
Yet they still just shame it because they're like, well, yeah, I'm trying to buy a new one. It's like, no, you're not.
Oh, because you are someone who likes Japanese maples.
Yes.
But you also think they're maybe a little overrated.
I think they're a little overrated. As one who's about to give a rating for them, I'm hoping not to fall into the same problem here.
Okay.
So here's where I'm at. So I love that they're an understory tree. I love seeing the trees that take that other route. They're like, nah, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to chill like this and I'm going to take it easy. But yeah, so these trees are coveted, especially if you can find some really big old ones that have been taken care of. But on the other side, people plant them in the worst places, like in the planter strip. You know, you want a big tree that's doing something cool. And then all of a sudden, Alex, they plant a dumb little Japanese maple. And the thing is just sitting there. You drive by and you're just like, what's the matter with that tree? You can literally see it gasping for water saying, help me. You're like, I can't do it. I don't even have to pee right now. I'm sorry.
Wow.
And I think they're overplanted. There are better trees. The snake bark maples. Just a little bit of creativity, people. That's all I'm asking, Alex. So here's what I'm going to do.
Okay.
there's 10 golden cones of honor that I can give to this tree, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so if you split that in half, we kind of have figured out that the top half is worth more than the bottom half. Does that feel like, or maybe it's like vice versa?
Yeah, no, it's a bit of a like Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, it's a little logarithmic, isn't it? Yeah, like no one's ever gonna be like one golden cone of honor because it's an okay tree. It's like I guess I maybe will. There's trees that they're coming up. Okay, I think it's a beautiful tree. I love how it works, and I love a good taken care of one. So I want to give it 4 for that.
I see what you're doing.
For being right there.
Gotcha.
But then I'm going to go to the top half. So it gets 4 out of 5 bottom half cones of honor.
An understory cone of honor.
Exactly. Yeah. However, for the upper story cone of honor, it just is so annoying to see new ones be planted. And the cultivars of them are just so ridiculous now. Where they're just like, there's so many and they do so many different things. I'm just like, you know what? Let's just get rid of the top 75% of those, give them back to nature, let the genes go back into the world and do whatever they can do best. And let's just stick with the really good ones. And let's just keep those really nice.
Minimize. Focus.
I'm going to give that a 2.5 golden cones of honor for it being overplanted, being a little bit of a, I don't know, it's just...
Right.
You know, I'm going to end it there. So I think it comes out to be a 6.5 golden cones of honor. I'm going to give it another 0.2 because I know that as soon as I'm done, I'm going to regret it. So 6.7 golden cones of honor for the Japanese maple.
There you have it. 6.7 golden cones of honor for the Japanese maple from dendrologist Casey Clapp.
It feels low, but I'm okay with this.
Casey, we're on the same page here.
We are?
Yeah.
You loved it, though, because you can see the whole thing. I'm sorry. I'm preempting.
Let me do my spiel.
Yeah, let me have it.
I have been up late at night thinking about this rating system.
Yeah.
Lately, we've been giving everything 7+.
Whoa. Were you even awake for the calorie pair?
Oh, I'm sorry. Besides that.
It was low. And
look at
low.
Last season. We were crazy about all those trees.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
And it starts to get a little boring and repetitive and kind of like, what's the point? Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take a page out of restaurant reviewing.
What?
You know Michelin stars?
Never heard of them.
Okay. Really?
No,
okay.
I have. I'm sorry.
Okay. So here's what the Michelin thing's about.
Okay.
You can have an amazing restaurant and have no Michelin stars.
Okay.
You can have an incredible restaurant and have one Michelin star.
Out of how many?
4.
Okay.
So there are 4 possible Michelin stars, mm-hmm. right? So a 4-star restaurant is like world class, the 1%.
Wow.
However, if you have any Michelin stars at all, it is still, you're still in like the top 5%.
What? It's that exclusive?
Yeah, it's a huge deal to get a Michelin star.
I had no idea.
So it's an honor, period, to have a golden cone of honor. That's why they're called the golden cone of honor.
All right. I think that, oh my God, you're kidding me. So you're saying...
Appearing on this show,
that automatically that gives the tree the status that
exactly.
it needs.
If you're a tree that we review on the show, we already think that you're special.
Yeah.
Right? So if you give a 2 golden cone of honor to a tree on the show, that's still pretty good.
This is extreme for me.
That's better than a tree that we don't review. So with that in mind,
okay.
Here's what I like about the Japanese maple. It is an underdog. It lives in the understory. It is content with its place in life.
Okay.
It has no aspirations. Mm. It knows where it grows.
Well said.
And it grows there very well. It doesn't grow big, but it grows extremely beautifully.
Mm.
It's a gorgeous tree. Mm-hmm. Its leaves are delicate, like origami. Mm. They're intricate and beautiful, beautifully designed, but they are small.
Okay.
It's small and beautiful.
Okay.
And it knows where it's supposed to be and it stays there. I think that's so honorable.
I agree. I also appreciate the poetics that you used just then.
I feel passionate right now.
Yeah, you look passionate. You're floating.
With all of this in mind,
okay.
I give the Japanese maple a 6.5.
A 6.5.
But I think it's an extremely well-earned 6.5.
Okay.
I think I could just as easily give it a 5.0.
I see. Okay.
In fact, Why don't I split the difference? I'm going to say a 5.75.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
5.75 golden cones of honor for the Japanese maple.
5.75. This is our first, 100th rating.
Well, to the Japanese maple, I say, you know.
Well earned.
Well earned. Casey, that was our review of the Japanese maple. It's time for our regular segment that we do every week.
What's this one?
When tree news breaks, there's only one source the Completely Arbitrary Boys turn to, and that is the Fungal Associated Press.
Oh, there we go. I love it.
Here's how it works. We have our Fungal Associates, the people who listen to the show, send us news articles to discuss about trees and other related topics, the kind of stuff we talk about on our show.
What? I'm looking at some of these. This is insane.
Let's go down the list here. The first one is from Camilla Southall. So this article is called Tankers and Transit Vans Sculpted into Steel Forests. Of course, you can find these articles on our website, completelyarbitrary.com, under the show notes for this week's episode. Artist Dan Rawlings has transformed a petrol tanker from a functional vehicle carrying fossil fuels into a work of intricate industrial beauty with a message about the power of nature. So what it looks like is that Mr. Rawlings has kind of like carved into the steel of the side of this tanker and made like a really intricate pattern of like a forest of trees.
These are so cool, man.
Yeah, they're gorgeous.
I want one of those. Like that, there's like a transit van, like a, a Ford Transit or something.
Yes.
Oh, I love it. I want to get the Mercedes. What are the ones that people drive around with these days?
Oh, like a Sprinter van?
Yeah, I want to do that with a Sprinter van and then just live inside of it, but then be like, no, sorry, I live in my van in the forest.
Get all your shit stolen.
Yeah, I probably will. Yeah, that's a good point.
So the article says he spent 4 months carving out the tank to leave only a steel skeleton of tree trunks, branches, and brambles, turning this once polluting vessel into a 3D forest sculpture.
Oh, my God.
And he says, there is definitely an environmental message.
Yeah. Obviously. So for those of you who are trying to like get this figured out, basically imagine a gas, like a tank truck that usually would carry gas or petrochemicals. Mm-hmm. And then he takes a blowtorch and carves that tank into a tree latticework that used to be a full tank.
Yes. And he says it's very labor intensive.
I could imagine.
But that's the bit I really enjoy. And if you scroll to the very bottom of this,
I wish I was an artist.
There is a sign, maybe like a parking sign that he has carved into the shape of a tree.
That is so cool.
And with a light shining on it, there's a shadow on the wall behind it that looks like a tree.
It looks perfect. That looks perfect.
It's gorgeous.
This is so fascinating. Oh, everyone needs to go look at these. They're on the website. But what's so fascinating about it is A, the time it would take to intricately. Thank you. Like cut out with like an oxyacetylene torch or something like that and just like carve these things out. There's an airplane? Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Well, that's one. Casey, our second article is from Andrea Duck.
Hello.
Meet the Appalachian apple hunter who rescued 1,000 lost varieties. Casey, we found your nemesis.
I will burn this man's forest to the ground. He's found nothing but trash that should have been left again as the Japanese maple varieties. Let's just give those genes back to nature. They were crushed and dissolved and were submissive to all the dominant genes for a reason. Why do we need them back?
For legal reasons, we mean this man no harm.
No, that's true.
Tom Brown's retirement hobby is a godsend.
No one burned down his forest.
In the name of Casey Clapp.
That was specifically to be funny.
They're going to name you in their note.
They will. Let's see what their manifesto.
Uh-huh.
Oh, God.
Take a cell phone video in their car right before they do it.
Yeah. This is my hero.
Tom Brown's retirement hobby is a godsend for chefs, conservationists, and cider. Here's what it says, Casey.
Conservationist, give me a break.
As Tom Brown leads a pair of young aspiring homesteaders through his apple orchard in Clemens, North Carolina, he gestures at clusters of maturing trees. A retired chemical engineer, the 79-year-old lists varieties and pauses to tell occasional stories. Unfamiliar names such as Black Wine Sap, Candy Stripe, Royal Lemon, Raven Bald, Yellow Bellflower, and Night Dropper pair with tales that seem plucked from pomological lore.
Pomological lore. Look at that.
My favorite new word.
Hey, it might be mine too.
So Casey, he says these apples belong to the foodways of my grandparents and great-grandparents' generation. These were what? Lost varieties?
Yeah, I'm reading through here as well, and I've heard about this before. In fact, I think I might have heard about this guy specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So historically, like, there were varieties of apples that would be grown for everything, just like any other variety of something. Johnny Appleseed is the classic example of this, because what is famous about apples specifically is that if you plant, if you have an apple seed or an apple, you take the seeds from it. If you plant those seeds, they will not grow to be similar to their parents. Apple seeds are famously variable in the traits that come up from the new seeds, right? So if you are planting an apple tree, then you have no idea what that apple is going to look like in terms of the fruit. You don't know how it's going to grow. You don't know anything about it. It's a crapshoot every single time.
Mm.
So Johnny Appleseed famously would just throw a bunch of apple seeds out as he would like walk from where? Like Pennsylvania over to like Indiana, Ohio or something like that. So he would just cruise by and just throw apple seeds out and then like create a little colony of apples and then pick out which ones work the best and then keep everyone going. Again, they would use them for booze back then. So what they did, what happened is that you have apples that would not grow very well down the south, and then you'd have apples that would just put out a bunch of random seeds. A couple of those seeds would work really well in your region. It's up high, it's down low, it's over here, it's over there, you know, more rain, less rain, dry, whatever it is. So you'd get all these weird different varieties that would work and grow well. But then they also started making apples that you could eat, and then they named them all those funny names that you just said.
Yeah.
So over time, some of those names were successful and sold really well regionally, and then they just got outcompeted, and for whatever reason, people didn't care about them, and now you only get the Red Delicious because those orchards were bigger and they sold for cheaper or whatever.
Right. So this man is sort of finding he's sort of rediscovering the world of lost apples that maybe weren't as popular back in the day.
And he's, I don't know.
1,000 varieties, Casey.
That's insane. Maybe I can get into this. Maybe this is going to finally put me over the edge.
Yeah.
Glenn, look at this. Look at that adorable man.
I know.
I love that.
He just looks like a sweetheart.
You know, anyone who's that stoked about apples and can name all these different varieties just by looking, I got to give some credit to that. That's pretty cool.
Our credit's to Tom Jones. Our third article is from longtime fungal associate Sarah Wanamaker. Hi, Sarah.
Whoa!
Sarah sent us an article, Extinct Date Palms Grown from 2,000-Year-Old Seeds Found Near Jerusalem.
That's so cool.
7 date palm trees have been grown from 2,000-year-old seeds that were found in the Judean desert near Jerusalem. The seeds, the oldest ever germinated,
wow.
Casey, were among hundreds discovered in caves and in an ancient palace built by King Herod the Great in the 1st century BC.
Isn't that the guy who, I think he had something to do with Jesus. I think he wanted Jesus to die because they're like, he's the new king. And Jesus was like, nah. Herod was like, nah, not on my watch.
Yeah, he was involved in that whole debacle.
that whole debacle.
Yeah. The ancient seeds were prepared by soaking them in water, adding hormones that encourage germination and rooting, then planting them in soil in a quarantined area. Doesn't sound that hard.
That's incredible. Oh, yeah. I mean, I do it all the time.
they just soaked them in water, and they're like, all right, they look decent enough to plant.
Good. I bet you someone tried it. Everyone always does that. They're like, would you try one of the dates?
Oh.
These are dates. Like, you eat them.
100% I would eat one of these dates.
That's talk about aging after being good after aging for a while.
You know, if Tom Brown's collection is impressive of 100-year-old apples, these 2,000-year-old dates are fucking mind-blowing.
That's pretty insane.
I mean, imagine the dishes. So you could take these dates, a world-renowned chef, mm-hmm. right, could take these dates and create a dish that has flavors that have not been tasted for 2,000 years.
That's exactly right. That's the next thing they talk about, is that, like, the Roman scribe Pliny the Elder, for example, wrote that their outstanding property is the unctuous juice. I think I'm reading that right. Unctuous juice, which they exude in the extremely sweet sort of wine flavor, like that of honey.
Yeah.
I've never thought that honey had a wine flavor. I should say that.
Oh, okay. Maybe a different. Yeah, well, honey is really a big player in Greek myth.
Yes,
and so they sort of drink it like wine.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, maybe they let it get a little meaty.
Yeah, I think it's meaty. And at the end of this article, it says previously the world's oldest germinated seed was a 1,300-year-old Chinese lotus seed.
Wow,
recovered from a dried lake bed in
That's
China.
Stunning.
I just want to meet the people who are looking for these things. It's crazy,
yeah, right? I guess honestly, you think they're looking at it, they just find it, and they're like,
"Yeah,
wonder what that tastes like."
Probably. In 2012, researchers in Russia grew a flower from 30,000-year-old fruit tissue.
Wow!
Recovered from frozen sediment in Siberia.
That's so cool.
Yeah, that kind of stuff's really, really fun. Casey, it's time for our completely arbitrary Q&A.
God, that was a great segment. Sorry, I don't want to end it. That was cool.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Should read more articles. I need more time.
Yeah. Well, you're going to have a lot more time in a couple months here.
That's true.
No spoilers.
No spoilers.
Unless you want to spoil something.
Yeah, I can do it now. I'm going to quit my job.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm not going to work for the city of Portland anymore. I know, everyone, I need you to stay still. It seems insane. I love my job. I love doing what I'm doing, but it's a time for me to move on and do a couple other things.
I'll be happy to have a little bit more time with you, not just as a friend, but as a business partner.
Yeah,
be
good. All of the above. So
it's time for our completely arbitrary Q&A, Casey. This week's question is from Riley Stark, a member of the Patreon Arboretum.
Hello, Riley.
Hi, Riley. Hi, Alex and Casey. Oh, hey. I have a question that the pod can maybe address in an upcoming episode. Much is known about trees, forestry, and arboriculture.
Never heard of it.
But not everything. As in all fields of scientific inquiry, there is always the possibility of new discoveries awaiting further research.
Oh.
What are some of the unknown concepts in the science of trees and their management?
That's actually a really interesting question. The reason that's so interesting is that the science of, like, about trees, like, I've talked about CODIT, like how trees grow and die and things.
Yeah.
That's, like, fairly new. Like, that started in, like, the 60s, 70s, maybe.
Really?
You know? Wow. Yeah. So, I don't know. That's a huge question because, yes, there's plenty to be known, but we humans are very hubristic creatures where once we learn a certain amount, we're like, we know everything. There
Good
is
enough.
Yeah, that's not the case here. So let's see. A perfect example. We don't know how the fungal associations work and everything.
Mm.
We're just now learning and being like, yes, this exists, but we don't know all the intricate things that come together and, you know, like how a whole forest functions at a very specific level. We can just observe what happens when we destroy it or we plant it or we do something. We can see what it was, what it is now, but we don't really know exactly how all those things work. Oh, the dodo and the fig wasp.
Yeah.
Those are a perfect example. We learned about that. For every one that we know, there's probably tens of millions that we don't know.
Right.
In terms of, like, arboriculture, how many roots can you cut and still have a tree live? You know, how, if a tree has decay in it, how much of the inside can be decayed until the tree is structurally unsound? You know, there's a bunch of different variables that come into this. And so we just don't know. You just have to kind of use your best guessing for that. But gosh, man, that's a big question, Riley. I would
assume it's like we don't know what we don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of it. And all you have to do is kind of like just think about all these things. I know there's 100 things that we've talked about. We're like, we just don't know.
Yeah.
Why is this tree deciduous and not that tree? You know, why does this tree grow like this? Why is it, what makes this tree so much better at doing this than other trees? You know? Why is the tree of heaven so invasive? Like, we can read and say, well, because it does this, does this, does this, but because it does those things does not explain why it does those
right.
things, you know? So it's like,
yes.
I don't know. Is it just a strategy? So we don't know. We can just observe what we've observed, but we don't know the whys about anything. And a lot of times we don't know the hows. We just learned that trees can fight off different, or send signals and kind of fight off the different things that, you know, come to attack it. So we're basically, I would say the big thing that we don't know is how much damage we've caused and how to fix it. And specifically, we don't know what was there before we came in and destroyed everything.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, here's a great example, Alex. All the indigenous knowledge that was lost with not only the colonization of the world, essentially, but let's just focus on the United States or North America. Even before, like, actually people came and said, I'm going to kill you and take your land, disease came and just massacred entire, you know, populations. So if we had enough, if we were lucky enough as a culture, meaning humanity, to have these, this, you know, these two meetings of the mind say, well, we're Western civilization, we think we know everything. It's like, well, we've been living here. We are this other civilization. We've been living here for this long. And then let's assume that we all got together and said, well, let's just make this work out. Then we could have talked to them and had like, oh, well, what is the relationship between these things? And then we could have had someone who'd been dealing, working with intimately that relationship for 10,000 years.
Yeah.
So that's what we don't know. Like we don't know the force and the interactions of trees and plants and us and other things. To a degree that's, you know, beyond the thickness of a piece of paper laying on its side.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that's, yeah, it's not a very good answer. It feels like it's superficial, but there's so many, you know.
I think that works, yeah. Like, I think that the biggest answer there is, like most things, we know a fraction of what there is to know.
Yeah, right. And I could think of 1,000 little examples of papers that I've read that are like, well, we know how this thing reacts, but we don't know why it reacts that way. We don't know how to predict it.
Thank you so much, Riley, for your question. If you have a question for Casey about trees, email us at arbitrarypod@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram at arbitrarypod. That's ARBORTRARY pod. You can join the Patreon to support us.
Yes, you can.
And support the podcast and support tree education.
There you go.
You can join the Arboretum for $5 a month. Get 2 extra episodes a month about other related topics. You can join the Cone of the Month Club and get a unique die-cut sticker of a cone illustration illustrated by an independent artist every month. We love our independent artists.
Yes, Casey, we do. Yes, we do.
As to ourselves.
Exactly, right?
Well, Casey.
Alex, we did it again.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Completely Arbitrary. We'll see you next time.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Completely Arbitrary is produced by Alex Croson and Casey Cloud.
Our artwork is by Jillian Barthold, and our music is by Aves and the Mini Vandals.
And you can support the podcast at patreon.com/arbitrarypod.
And find additional readings at completelyarbitrary.com. Thanks for listening.